Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 17th of August. We're happy to have Barbara Ehrenreich with us this hour. She has written so much. Op-ed piece that was in the New York Times on August 9 caught our attention. Is it now a crime to be poor? First paragraph starts, it's too bad so many people are falling into poverty at a time when it's almost illegal to be poor. You won't be arrested for shopping in a dollar store, but if you are truly deeply in the streets poor, you're well advised not to engage in any of the biological necessities of life, like sitting, sleeping, lying down, or loitering. City officials boast that there's nothing discriminatory about the ordinances that afflict the destitute, most of which go back to the dawn of gentrification in the 80s and 90s. If you're lying on a sidewalk, whether you're homeless or a millionaire, you're in violation of the ordinance, said a city attorney in St. Petersburg, Florida. Barbara is she's an author, she's a journalist, she's an activist. She says that her work settles into three tracks: journalism, generally essays and opinion pieces, book-length projects on subjects which she says may not make any money, but fascinate her and give her life some intellectual continuity. She is author of Nickel and Dimed, For Her Own Good, 200 Years of the Expert's Advice to Women, The Hearts of Men, American Dreams and the Flight from a Commitment, Fear of Falling, The Inner Life of the Middle Class, and a number of other books. She has, I think that this one may have just been released, or I'm not sure if it has or not. She's done research on a lot of different, Bait and Switch. We talked to her about that one as well, which motivated her to do something new, to build an organization for unemployed, underemployed, and anxiously employed white-collar workers. And she has she's at work on other projects as well, which we'll talk about. Dancing in the Streets, I think that's already been released. And we'll be welcoming phone calls for Barbara, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk at WPR.org. Hello, Barbara. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, nice to be with you again, Kathleen.
I didn't know you were born in Butte, Montana. I was reading about you yesterday.
Yeah.
Butte, Montana. I don't know.
Not many people can say that.
No, they certainly can't. And that you have this incredibly rich scientific background.
I was educated as a scientist. Ended up with a PhD in cell biology, which I don't use much anymore, but now and then it's handy.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure everything is handy in the line of work that you do, right?
Uh-huh.
That's part of why you do what you do. This was, you draw our attention to something that I think many of us don't know about, that, and you cite so many examples in the op-ed piece, and I'm sure you have many more, of people who find themselves in jail literally for being poor.
Yes, this is not an aspect of poverty I had thought much about, and I certainly have been writing about poverty in America for a long time now. But I could not avoid it. When I set out on to report for a series of essays in the New York Times on what was happening to the already poor in the recession, this just kept coming up. Mm-hmm. In May, I was in L.A., talking to community organizers and advocates for the homeless, and that, you know, it was just inescapable. And they even used the phrase, the criminalization of poverty. And I thought, that, you know, I had not fully accepted this. One part of it is, you know, that low-income neighborhoods, which tend to mean black and Latino neighborhoods in this country, are tend to be policed with exceptional zeal to catching people for very small infractions like jaywalking, all of which carry fines.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about the number of ordinances against the publicly poor has been going up since the year 2006 in an attempt to, what, get these people off the streets? They don't care where, but get them, they're an eyesore?
Well, it all started, I think, with gentrification and the need to kind of purify, cleanse urban areas, ethnically cleanse urban areas for, you know, more affluent, generally white people to come into. And then in the 90s, this got a little bit mean with Mayor Giuliani in New York and his police chief, William Bratton, who adopted a new policy called the broken windows approach, or the zero tolerance approach to policing, which rested on the strange idea that if you could stop the smallest crimes, you would stop the bigger crimes too. You know, if there's no graffiti around, maybe somebody will be less inclined to commit murder or something. I don't know. So that's when this crackdown really began, and it spread from city to city. As L.A. in particular is one of the cities that adopted this approach, so that people in low-income neighborhoods actually live in, you know, quite a bit of fear of the police. They may have felt, you know, 20 years ago that they were neglected by the police. Now they like to, they're more likely to think that they get way too much intrusion by the police.
Mm-hmm. You cite a case, which I had no idea this was in existence, a teenager caught in public housing in New York City without an ID, you might be visiting a friend or a relative, can be charged with criminal trespassing, and you can wind up in juvenile detention.
Yeah, now that, to me that's just crazy. But police can conduct sweeps, police sweeps through public housing. And I don't know how many other cities have a rule like New York's, but this is something I found out from the Children's Defense Fund. You know, that you could be going there to visit grandma in the public housing. And, you know, teenagers don't often have IDs if they don't have driver's licenses. And that could be enough to start your criminal career. This is what the Children's Defense Fund calls the cradle-to-prison pipeline.
Mm. Tell us this story. It's one of the more dramatic ones in your piece. I don't know how to pronounce his last name, but the gentleman who was inhabiting a wheelchair on G Street in Washington, Al. What's Al's last name?
Exactly.
Exactly. Al's story is so poignant.
Well, yeah, here's a Viet vet. He told me his, a bullet he took in the spine in 1972 in Vietnam accounts for his being confined to a wheelchair. And he lives outdoors pretty much. But last December, he was lucky enough to have a bed in a homeless shelter in D.C. Then there was a police sweep of that homeless shelter. It's called a warrant sweep. When the police sweep through a place to see if they can find anybody with outstanding arrest warrants. So they wake up Al Zeckley in bed. It turns out he does have a warrant out for him for, quote, criminal trespassing, which he earned by sleeping on a sidewalk in a suburb of D.C.
Oh, my.
That was called criminal trespassing. So he gets dragged out of the shelter bed.
Oh, my. Oh, no. I know.
And taken to jail.
Oh.
You know, there, you know, for the crime of being homeless, right? And unfortunately, then he lost his bed in that shelter. He's a man of 62, looks a lot older, I must say, and now lives outdoors. My initial thought was, well, that can't be that bad in the summer, right? But no, some of the homeless men I talk to in D.C. actually hate the summer more because of the mosquitoes.
Mm-hmm.
They have no defense against that.
Mm. And you talk about maybe it was Al or somebody else who just scratched the bites and had kind of raw...
Oh, yeah. No, he was just frenetically scratching while we talked, which made me a little bit itchy
yeah.
to watch. You know, it just was painful.
Yeah. And somebody described this, and you quote them, they arrested a homeless man in a shelter for being homeless.
Yeah, that was a quote from Eric Sheptock, a man who is homeless himself and also a very strong advocate for other homeless people.
What's the future for Al? What's Al going to do?
I guess I could go out and try to find him, but he's just, you know, it's a pretty much a day-to-day proposition living in the streets.
Mm. How about this anti-food sharing campaign?
All right, this took my breath away, you know, because it shows a kind of viciousness that I cannot comprehend. Some years ago, there's some unclarity in my mind and exactly when, but it could be as much as 20 years ago, a group called Food Not Bombs started distributing free food in public parks in some cities to the indigent, you know, which may not be homeless people, but people who don't have enough to eat, right? And they have continued this practice. And then this has excited the anger of some city officials in Las Vegas, for example. A law was passed, a statute against food sharing with indigent people. You and I, Kathleen, could probably sit down and share some food, at least if we looked pretty respectable at the moment. But we could not share our food with somebody who looked a little bit, like they might be indigent, pretty, you know, grungy looking.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, this is, to me, you know, that's an attack on, you know, not only on the poor, but then anybody who would like to help the poor.
Of course.
And to me, it's also an attack on, you know, some basic principles of religion and ethics, that you do help the poor. But their attacks on food sharing with the homeless have gone on in Orlando and Middletown, Connecticut, and a number of cities.
Hmm. Part of this, and you talk about it in terms of when one of your creditors has a court summons that's issued for you, and you talk about this in other of your books as well, that starts, one thing starts this vicious cycle, and it's almost impossible to get yourself back on your feet.
Yeah, I mean, the examples we've been talking about have, you know, these are ones where we're particularly vulnerable if you are homeless or you are black or brown in skin color. But there are other things that can happen that are pretty scary. You can get into debt, which is easy enough, right?
Sure.
And then one of your creditors could have a court summons issued for you, so that you come into, are supposed to come into court and explain what your assets are, what your problems are, and why you're not paying this. Well, you might not get that court summons. I can understand this completely. You know, you might have a job that you can't take a day off from, or you might have changed your address.
Sure.
So the court summons doesn't follow you. Then you are in contempt of court, which is, you know, not in itself, I guess, a criminal offense. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know. But that can be the beginning of a lot more problems. Now, I was shocked to find out that in Texas, if you are behind on fines for parking, for traffic, for whatever, you can be sent to jail just to, quote, sit out your fines.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, we don't have debtors' prisons, right? In America, but that's a debtor's prison. That's what they're doing.
Whew. Barbara Ehrenreich is our guest. We have a ton of phone calls for her, and we'll welcome them in a moment. If you'd like to join us in just a little while, 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Barbara Ehrenreich is our guest. She's author of a number of very important books. I think one of my favorite of her recent contributions to the world of American literature and activism was when she went undercover as a worker and tried to get by on minimum wage, nickel and dimed on not getting by in America. If you haven't read it yet, it's worth a read. We're concentrating our conversation this hour on an August 9 op-ed piece she wrote for the New York Times, Is It Now a Crime to Be Poor? We go to phone calls for Barbara. Brett from Eau Claire is first. Hi, Brett.
Good morning.
Hi.
My comment is I'm the director of the Chippewa Valley Free Clinic in Eau Claire. We provide free health care to people who can't afford it. And I think one of the things that is really easy to do, and Barbara's book, Nickel and Dimed, was fantastic at helping to share this information, is that the mentality of being poor is so different from being middle class or high or upper class that when you are poor, you have no options in many ways, or you have very, very few options. And that leads people to different choices than I would make or than some of my donors would make to our clinic. And so it's very easy to judge this population and just jump in and say, well, they're wrong or they're this or they're that. But if society doesn't provide them the options, then they can't make good choices.
And tell me, they're coming to the clinic, they have no health insurance, how do they find themselves in this position, Brett?
Well, like Barbara's book points out, our society values certain types of work, and other types of work they don't value.
Mm-hmm.
So we have housekeepers and fast food workers and people who are on, they do telemarketing and other types of things that they come to our clinic because their employer doesn't pay for their health insurance. And in many cases,
right.
Our patients are working three jobs, three part-time jobs, so that, you know, no employer will give them a full-time job, and they're doing full-time work between the three jobs, but
mm-hmm.
They just can't get that access. And if you have, if you are low income, being able to pay for your health care with deductibles and premiums and copays is practically impossible. And so the types of things such as crime and other issues that are related to poverty issues are very natural when you think about someone's back against the wall. I often say not that these individuals are you know, obviously dogs or anything like that, but if a hurt animal is cornered, even if it's your pet or something like that, you can expect that animal to bite you. And if we don't help this population and help them to heal and to grow and to have options and to feel safe and to feel encouraged, then of course we're going to find problems. And so it's hard to expect a hurting person to act like a healthy person.
Right.
Well, Brett, I commend you for your work with the free clinic. That's really, really important. I just want to clarify, though, what I'm looking at here are not crimes in the sense that they, you know, really cause harm to other people or, you know, are in some moral sense transgressions. I'm looking at sort of manufactured crimes or crimes that are differentially enforced. There was an interesting study from a sociologist in Queen's College recently who found that there's actually been an increase in arrests for possession of marijuana in New York almost entirely among black and Latino young men. You know, that's targeting. I don't think that should be a crime in the first place, but anyway, that's targeting. Another thing is something like jaywalking. All right, you shouldn't do it, right? It's dangerous. But if I do that outside my house, I don't think I'm going to be arrested. If I did that and I was a person of color in South Central L.A., I might well get a ticket. Or another one is the growing practice in a growing number of cities of issuing tickets to children or teenagers who are not in school during school hours, which may mean they're simply late,
mm-hmm.
right? But the ticket is $250 in L.A. It's $500
in
Dallas.
How are you going to pay that? Well, as a result, if you're going to be late, don't go to
school. You're beginning to build up a bad record with the police right there.
Right.
So I'm not talking about, you know, holding up the convenience store, which I could also understand if you're desperate.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about what amounts almost to harassment.
Right. You may want to send us more information, Brent, about what you're doing. We're doing a major healthcare conference, 2 hours. Well, we're doing healthcare focus on Tuesdays at 10, and we're doing a major conference at Frederick on September 16. So please get in touch with us. I'll give you my email and Rhonda's so that we can link with you for that conference, okay?
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Brent. Thanks for the call. So our email is Dunn, D-U-N-N-K, at WPR.org, and Rhonda's is Fanning, F-A-N-N-I-N-G, at WPR.org. So We'd like to hear from you and see if we can have you be a part of that healthcare conference. Yeah, this truancy thing is, I had no idea the fines were. Wasn't there an outcry about this? How in the world can you charge this?
In L.A., there's some organizing against it coming from, oddly enough, the Bus Riders Union, which is an organization, you know, created for people who are depend on the buses in L.A., which is the poor. And the Bus Riders Union got involved because so many of these truancy tickets were being issued to kids who were late, maybe just even a few minutes late, because the bus, the city bus, went right by their stop. It was too full to pick them up. So that's why they were, you know, 10 minutes late for school and got caught by the police for that, quote, crime.
Thanks, Brent. Linus is next from Gays Mills. Hi, Linus.
Hi. I wanted to make two quick comments. One about Food Not Bombs, which you mentioned earlier, that provides vegetarian meals in public parks for people who need food. Well, a lot of their food comes from grocery stores. They throw out fruits and vegetables on a daily basis, which are still pretty fresh. And a lot of the members, they get it out of these, you know, dumpsters. They're pretty clean. We wash them off, and then we cook them up. But in a lot of cities, it's illegal to do that. And especially in Vegas, I've had friends who've gone and done prison time for up to a year for trying to procure food to feed people. And on a second note, instead of wasting away underemployed in Seattle, I hit the road a couple months ago, and I've been hitchhiking the country, and it's amazing, you know, if you're just walking around with a backpack, how the police just pick up on you like that, and you can end up handcuffed in the back of the car while they search your stuff with, you know, a lot of times they'll arrest you and not charge you, but for suspicion, to put you in a lineup, and they could hold you in jail for up to 24 hours at a time.
That's happened to you, Linus? That's happened to you?
Yeah. It's happened to me in Kansas City, and it's a real pain. I'll tell you that much. But and also, I believe, I don't like the term poor. I prefer the term financially challenged. People of lower incomes have really become like the whipping post for the rest of society. I mean, if you don't have any money, you know, people look at you like, what's wrong with you? And there's this thing that's been, this little trend in the southern states, like Florida, where teenagers will go out and they'll try to find some, you know, homebum sleeping in the bushes, and they'll throw gasoline on them and set them on fire. And maybe that's an extreme example, but people harass you if you're on the street,
Yeah. Even
if you're not doing anything. It's just, I guess people want to feel superior.
Where are you on your way to, Linus? Are you just hitchhiking all over now?
Pretty much. I'm staying at a friend here in Wisconsin, but I'm hanging around the Midwest because the recession, as far as I've heard, has not hit the Midwest as bad as it's hit the West Coast, and I'm doing odd work and trying to find an opportunity and a situation to settle in, you know, get myself off the street and whatnot.
Barbara.
Wow. Well, Linus, thanks so much for calling with that story. I just want to clarify, you're talking about people in Las Vegas who served 2 years for dumpster diving in order to get the food to share with poor people,
and
if I still use the word poor, I mean, I think it'd be poor. I think it can be poor and proud, and then we have to fight that stigma. But that's what so the crime was there, was dumpster diving?
And it's illegal in a lot of cities to dumpster dive, where you will go to jail.
Well, see, then that's another, you know, why should that be a crime? I mean, I don't get it. If there's usable food or anything else in a dumpster, anyway, Linus, you have clarified a lot of things, and I think I'm really glad you called up and just give us a sense of what it's like to be on the street, like, you know, with a backpack. You are, you said, you are just almost a marked man then.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call, Linus. Let's go next to Rick from Mellon. Hi, Rick.
Good morning, Kathleen, to you and your guest. Personally, I think that all this kind of stuff started in the 1960s after the murder of President Kennedy. I think it was the left decided at that time, principally the Democrat Party, that the main thing to do was to attack the notion of American exceptionalism, and that's when they started borrowing all kinds of so-called political solutions from Europe. We got the 68 gun bill and wild deficit financing from Adolf Hitler, and we got affirmative action from Joseph Stalin. That's just a couple of examples of how the left has borrowed from the Europeans. But every time one of these big gun control bills gets passed, going all the way back to the 1930s under FDR, we get a big bump up in the police. In FDR's case, the FBI was enormously enhanced, and they were issued heavy weapons like Thompson machine guns, which in retrospect most of the agents obviously didn't know how to handle without killing innocent civilians by mistake. Then, especially under the Clintons, when they arrived, we had 600,000 government police before the Clintons. So the Clintons, as part of their crime control bills, ostensibly the assault weapon ban, added another 100,000 government cops on top of that. And this has created an escalating process. I heard the other day we have 1 million government police in the United States, and that doesn't count all the private ones, you know, like Pinkertons and God only knows what.
All right, Barbara, take it on.
Well, Rick, I don't know if there are too many things we agree on, but I think we have some common ground here. I'm one of those people from the left, and I have to say I winced at your characterization of the left, but I think we could agree that the policing in America has gotten a little heavy-handed. And you're right. I mean, I'm a Democrat. I mean, I vote Democratic, but you know, this trend really escalated under Clinton a lot. From Reagan through Clinton, you got this huge buildup in the number of Americans incarcerated, so that we now lead the world with 2.3 million people incarcerated. And, of course, that doesn't count all the people who are on parole or probation or something like that, who are under the grip of the criminal justice system. And I think that's alarming, and maybe there's something, you know, there's something here that libertarians of both the right and the left can get together on.
Yeah. What about this poor people? You talk about the somebody from a community organization in L.A. suspecting that poor people have become a source of revenue for recession-starved cities.
Well, I was fascinated by this allegation or suspicion. It was a community organizer who, like several others around the country, told me they suspect that, or they felt, they sensed that the level of this kind of police crackdown in poor communities was actually increasing since the recession. Oh, come on, how can that be? Well, actually, now studies, you know, that I cite show that it has. But there, the suspicion of these organizers was, well, it's just the city just wants the fine money. Now, there's no way to prove that. I mean, I would love to have a way to sneak inside the a police department and you know, hear if there are, you know, some kind of pep talks about go out there and, you know, collect all the fines you can today because we're running out of money.
Right.
I doubt it, though.
Right. Yeah. Let's go to Dan from Franksville. Hi, Dan.
Okay. Well, in Wisconsin here, we got a privatized prison industry. But for the last 15 or 20 years, it's been the case here that if you're broke, if you're low on money, you are going to jail because, first of all, you're going to need a car or whatever to get to work and stuff like that. If you get a ticket and you won't be able to pay that ticket because you're half broke, and they even had some insurance law, I think they went through. But anyhow, the second ticket you get, though, will be because you didn't pay the fine. They jerk your license after one fine hasn't been paid. They jerk your license. Then you will be going to jail. But that's probably a good thing for the economy because they're gonna farm you out to some private place to work as like a prison labor, and then that will drive the jobs away from the people that are looking for jobs that haven't been put in jail yet, and then there'll be more people put in prison, and the privatized prison industry, one of the biggest lobbyists here in Wisconsin, the cash is going to flow right in there. Because these boys really know how to run the welfare wagon in the Madison, so they lobby, get all that cash to flow in from the prison industry. And, what you sort of say is true. You are going to jail in Wisconsin if you get long cash.
Barbara.
Wow. That's a very good point, Dan, about the driving. I mean, it's so easy to fall behind, say, in car insurance payments, get your car insurance cut off, and then maybe you get stopped for something like a broken headlight, which is not a cheap thing to fix.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that could be several hundred dollars, but you can't get that done. Anyway, it just starts this cascade of disasters that can lead to prison. I'm not so sure this is good for our economy, though, because, what we're seeing now is states like California being forced to actually release some prisoners. You know, they just cannot, we can't afford to incarcerate this many of our people.
Well, the number you said in the article is up pretty significantly, 37 million in 2007. Some think it may be as high as 50 million now.
That's the number of poor people.
Oh, the number of poor people.
Yeah,
the number of prisoners
in prison
are 2.3 million. 2.3, the same number of people who are in public housing, right?
Yeah, that's what I thought was striking.
Yeah. So they're beginning to change. They're beginning to send perhaps nonviolent drug offenders home or to rehabilitation. Are they going to rehabilitation or are they going back on the streets or where?
Well, there's some trend in some states toward a little bit of what I consider to be sanity, is saying, well, why have we locked up all these people who are nonviolent, like for possession of marijuana or something, and to say we have to reevaluate that. And so they send them instead to a drug court, for example, to deal with a community service or if treatment is required or even if it isn't, to require treatment. That's a little bit saner approach than what some other states are taking, which is to say, well, we're running out of money and we've got all these bad guys, so we're going to have to charge them for their room and board in prison.
Oh, when you don't have any money. Right, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Dan, thanks very much for your call. Philip from Dodgeville, hello.
Hi. I have a question slightly off topic. But internationally, I visited a country called Bangladesh a few years ago, and I saw a lot of poor people. And when I saw a lot of the poverty there, a lot of the people, I saw places where people would be arrested or abused for being in rich areas, and they wanted to get, in a sense, homeless people away from certain places to make them look presentable. And so I imagine there's similar things happening in America. And I'm just kind of curious, when in Bangladesh, I saw tons of people who didn't really have, they had a lot less opportunities than, say, here in America to even get out of that. And so I saw a lot more people who I felt like were undeserving to be in those situations. And I'm just kind of curious as to, in America, how do we compare to other countries? And I feel like when I've come back to America, that I've seen the people who I've seen who are on the streets, to some degree, are more likely putting themselves there than have unfortunately gotten themselves there. Do you understand my question?
Yeah, let me just pick up on that last part, Philip. How are they putting themselves there? You're making it sound like it's sort of a choice to be destitute or homeless.
Well, people wouldn't necessarily, again, make the choice to be homeless, but I think that I've seen people make choices like to use drugs and to abuse drugs, and that has put a significant amount of people on the streets.
Well, I think you might be right, but it might be that also you should bear in mind that the stress and difficulty of living on the street might be enough to turn people toward drugs, too. I'm just throwing out that possibility.
Okay.
But I think overall, you know, you have to realize that there are some structural causes for poverty in America that have very little to do with personal choice, very little you can do about it. If you start out poor, if you don't get a good education, or even if you do sometimes in the recession, during this recession, you can end up destitute. no matter how, you know, what your efforts are. And I think that's one thing that the recession should really bring home to us. You know, as we see, you know, the lines in the at the for the food pantries and so on, don't just include people in scruffy clothes. They, you know, I've seen them on YouTube. I've seen pictures of them. They include, you know, people who were white collar workers a little while ago, and have started to spiral down. If you talk to homeless people and get their backstories, I think you will be fascinated, Philip, and you'll see the diversity, the huge diversity, in among, you know, that population.
And why is it that we don't spend much time? We were talking about this some last hour, decrying the coverage of healthcare reform debate in this country, looking for an Edward R. Murrow kind of documentary on Harvest of Shame, of looking at what people are facing when it comes to that issue in this country. And instead we get junk, you know, we get it from liberal media, what liberal media there is. We get it from conservative media instead of getting the complete kind of thing. You have to go to YouTube to find this instead of our being generally aware. Your story came as an eye-opener to all of us because nobody reports on this, Barbara.
Yeah, I can't explain that. I can't explain why I was somewhat ignorant of it myself. As for, you know, the healthcare, we do have some very good, you know, we have that movie Sicko that Michael Moore did. Was that 2007? I don't remember, but it is as fresh and relevant to the current moment as ever.
But it's not enough when the news is framing the issue in terms of death panels and et cetera, instead of talking about what's going on in free clinics or the number of people in L.A. or waiting, and in various parts of the country waiting for free health care, the number of homeless people who need health care. I mean, it's a whole different, we're missing.
Yeah, well, the whole death panel thing has nothing to do with health care.
Right, of course.
I mean, this is a revolt. This is the people who don't think we should have a black, somewhat liberal president. And I don't think it has, you know, it has no rational connection to health care.
Yeah. Thanks, Philip, for the call. Our number, we have some lines open now. Barbara Ehrenreich is our guest. We're talking about a piece she wrote in the August 9, it's an op-ed piece, New York Times, on asking the question, is it now a crime to be poor? Joan from Milwaukee, hello.
Hello. Thank you very much for the program.
Sure.
I only caught part of it, but I have a granddaughter who's out of work, and because, well, I have two that are out of work, but one is working at a bar, partly because when you go to get a job, guess what? They don't just check your felony record or your arrest record even. They check your credit score at a lot of places, not just banks. And so that's getting to be a real problem, how credit scores are used. Or if somebody goes, oh, here's a good one. I know that the car insurance places check your credit score, and your price is probably higher. They probably take you on, but you get a higher price if you've got a low credit score. And now with Wisconsin switching to a car insurance state when we weren't, it's just going to exacerbate all of that. And I just think you ought to send a copy of this program to the White House and let them go through this, because this is insane.
Thank you, Joan, for bringing up that business of using credit scores to judge whether people should be hired for jobs.
I didn't know that was being done.
That is a catch-22. Right. And I mentioned this in my book, Bait and Switch. I found it sort of unbelievable. But the practice has only grown, and there is now a group, unfortunately, I can't think of their name, but if you Google enough about employment and credit scores, you will find them, that is, dedicated to trying to stop this practice. Because, you know, it's the people who are desperate, who need jobs. I hope Philip is still listening here. You know, you can't get that job if your credit has suffered because you're unemployed, for example. And so you're just spiraling downward.
Right. I had no idea that was being done.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's I think it's being going to be challenged legally, I hope, you know, that's a form of discrimination. It is irrelevant to whether you can do the job you want to have. I mean, you can have a really hard period of rough times, and I'm here thinking about, you know, white-collar managerial professional people who are maybe making even six figures before their job loss. Then they lose their health insurance with the job.
Right.
Then they run up some debts because they have no health insurance. And then they go to get another job, and surprise, their credit rating is too low.
Hmm.
You know, it's insane.
Yeah. Barbara Ehrenreich is our guest this hour. Barbara Ehrenreich is our guest, and Frank from Madison, our next caller. Hi, Frank.
Hi.
Hi.
Really fine guest. Someone with a moral imagination. I'd like to make a general suggestion, which is that the poor and the criminalization of the poor is part of a general sort of looking away, but also looking for someone for whom you might have contempt because you're afraid of the obligation that you might have to another. And the culture has been moving that way for well over two decades, you know, maybe during the Nixon years, if you were looking, you know, for a fulcrum. And so we don't really see the working class described, you know, middle-class families, right, or the middle class. Somehow, if you have a union job, you might be in that category, right? And the poor are somehow there because of what they've done. They're guilty of something. And once you get to that point, you can then begin to actually criminalize being poor. You can put the laws in place that make them guilty of something. So, but it's a long shift from belonging to a community and having responsibility for others to those who are unfortunate are obviously guilty of something. So thank you.
Thank you, Frank, as always. Barbara.
Yeah, thanks, Frank, for your kind words. I would say it's not just a fear that we might have some responsibility toward those who are less fortunate, though you're right about that, too. I think that it's very comforting, if you're affluent, to explain other people's misfortunes in terms of their own failures. You know, so I could say, oh, well, I've got a nice place to live, I've got nice clothes, and if that person doesn't, well, she's just not, you know, she's not as hardworking as me, she's not as virtuous, not as upright. You know, that kind of thing is very flattering, self-flattering, to those who are more affluent. And we've done that for a long time, just stigmatized the poor, covered them with stereotypes, they're lazy, they're promiscuous, they're addicted, and so on.
Do you think, Barbara, that those attitudes change at all? You were mentioning the number of people who have maybe been in the upper income categories who have lost their jobs and who just aren't doing very well at all. Does that increase our empathy for other human beings when we find ourselves, and you would think there are more and more people who are finding themselves in that situation?
Yes, I should hope so. You know, that you can't, when you realize it can happen to you, then things change. And that's one of the things we try to pick up on in United Professionals, the group that I'm involved with and helped start, is, and that's unitedprofessionals.org. You know, that this is happening to a lot of people who never expected it to happen, but they do now have something in common with those people who have always relied or had to rely many times in their lives, say, on food stamps. Mm-hmm. Or something like that. They see things very differently. And I've talked to people in that situation and said, I just thought everybody on getting any kind of assistance was some kind of criminal or really lazy. Now I see what you have to go through to try to get any assistance. I've changed my mind entirely.
Right. Thanks, Frank, for your call. Catherine from Madison. Hi.
Hi, I just wanted to additionally to what the credit reports are being used for is to determine your renter's insurance rate. There's not every single state, but Wisconsin is one, and I know I lived in Colorado, and it's also used there. I think it's in the number of 40. I've been trying to look it up, but I can't find the exact amount.
Very interesting, Catherine. So you know, that is another way in which you are really marked down if you are in, have been in any kind of financial trouble.
Yes,
you're really stigmatized. Really,
for a person penalized. Leaving their house because of the mortgage crisis and then going, oh, yeah, and of course they use the credit rating also to get apartments.
Mm-hmm.
So, and
very good point.
Yeah, it can spiral down just like you were saying.
Yeah.
Thank you, Catherine.
Thank you.
Daryl from Le Clure. Hi, Daryl.
Good morning, Kathleen and Barbara Ehrenreich. And thank you so much for your good work in this program. I just had a comment. This reminds me of a song by Iris DeMent, and the title is Living in the Wasteland of the Free. And in that song, there is a line, where the poor have become the enemy. Thank you.
Mm. That's very interesting. I'll have to check that song out.
Right.
Yeah. But it is crazy, but that seems to be what happened. You know, they are the sort of designated scapegoats of our society. Unfortunately, they're not a group that just remains the same, you know, a sort of a subcaste or ethnic group or anything else. Anybody can join the poor.
Thanks, Daryl. Gloria from Dodgeville. Hi.
Hi, yes. Oh, thank you for having this program. I think that's great. I think we need something. We need universal health care. We need single payer. I was one of the people that was marched at the Capitol, I don't know how many weeks ago, 3-4 weeks ago, and there were thousands of people there. And looking on the news, you know, the local news to see if something was there. There was nothing that was listed or nothing that was presented in the local news. And I know that the other people on the other side, the insurance companies, are out there spending millions. I want to say something like $1.6 million at least, if not more, a day propaganding so that we don't get insurance or we don't have health care for everybody, which is so sad because so many terrible, terrible stories out there. And even if you do have health insurance, you are afraid actually to go to the doctor because then you're harassed to figure because you don't get your bills paid. I mean, they try to do things so not to pay it. So thank you so much.
Thanks for the call, Barbara.
Thank you, Carol. I think I was there, too. I didn't at that rally in Washington, D.C., and you're right, there was no coverage.
We go next to Kathy from somewhere in Wisconsin. Hi, Kathy.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And thanks for having Barbara. I love your work. I'm so glad people are making the point that there's an assumption that people who are poor are lazy, don't want to work. It's so not true. I also have a husband who works for a county jail, who works for a prison, and the assumption, and it's just factually incorrect, that we have prisoners or jail people who are making money for us in Wisconsin. It is so expensive. They are making cutbacks. People would be shocked how they are cutting back on help, on on corrections officers. But it's so untrue that we're making money. It costs a lot of money. The people there are many times there for small things. And jail is in the county, and prison is much more frequent offenses, criminal offenses, but it's just sad that people make these assumptions. My son is very close to this, works two jobs. He's just lucky he has family, you know, because we can help him. If he lost his jobs, if my husband lost his job, we would be in trouble, and the middle class just doesn't want to look at that because they are so close and they're scared.
Right.
Mm-hmm. No, good point, Kathy. I think that the prison system has become an intolerable, you know, financial burden in many ways. It costs a lot of money. That's why we have to work for alternatives and make sure that corrections officers are paid decently, like anybody else.
Yeah. And then there, you've got this whole issue. We only have 20 seconds, but this whole issue of young people who are having to work two jobs or three jobs, who are college educated, living with their parents because they can't find work. That's another huge issue in this country that I think is under-noticed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, Barbara, thank you so much for being with us. As always, a pleasure, and thanks for all of your work.
Well, thank you.
Barbara Ehrenreich, our guest, and if you want to reference the op-ed piece that she wrote that we were discussing this hour, it's Is It Now a Crime to Be Poor? It's in the August 9 issue of the New York Times. Barbara, of course, a very prolific writer. If you haven't read Nickel and Dimed on Not Getting By in America, it's an extraordinary piece of reporting in which she really went underground to find out how difficult it is to get by on minimum wage in this country or less. And she did it for quite a long period of time. So did or didn't do it. It was hard. So that's well worth a read. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. Thanks for all of your calls and for listening, everybody. We'll be with you again tomorrow from 9 to 11, our healthcare series continuing at 10 o'clock tomorrow. This is the Ideas Network.